The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Lymphoma, plasma cell dyscrasias, and myelodysplastic syndrome is presented by Dr. Cheryl Kowalski.
So lymphoma is a malignancy of solid lymphoid tissue. There's uncontrolled proliferation, and in the recent WHO classification in 2016, they have 93 types. We're not going through all 93. So we can divide them into two major categories. And again, just like with lung cancer, with leukemia, with lymphoma, the reason we're dividing them into two big categories is because of treatment. A little bit off there. So in non-Hodgkin lymphoma, the classification, the first one is low grade. That's still the same, and that you can see small lymphocytic, follicular, cleaved, and you see it more common with advancing age. And it's usually indolent, but again, just like CLL, generally considered incurable. And these lymph nodes can get bigger and smaller for years. And the survival of untreated disease, years. Again, no benefit for early intervention for most patients. So the next category that has been changed, which was formerly known as intermediate grade, is now aggressive. And this, we see the most common one, diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. And this is a firm enlarging mass. They may or may not have B symptoms. And survival, if untreated, is generally months as opposed to years. And then high grade, which is now known as highly aggressive, where we see anything blastic, that's a bad thing, and Burkitt's falls in that category. With aggressive treatment, you can achieve remission, and usually it's a rapidly enlarging lymph node mass, and survival, if untreated, is generally considered weeks. So you need a lymph node biopsy to make the diagnosis, and this is really important. I don't think it's going to be on the boards, but you need to take this through life. Fine needle aspirate is inadequate. They need a piece of that. A core will do, but if you can get the whole lymph node, so much the better, and please share that with your interventional radiologists. So let's look at non-Hodgkin's lymphoma first. So diagnosis, when you're working the patient up, you're going to get your routine lab, including a beta-2 microglobulin. You're going to do radiography with CT scans, diagnostic CT scans of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis, in addition to your PET scan. Now, we know that a CAT scan comes with the PET scan, but it is non-diagnostic. It's non-contrasted generally. And we need the diagnostic one because it actually can measure the size of lymph nodes, which the one with the PET does not. They can do them at the same time, but you have to request it specifically that way. Most of the patients will require bone marrow biopsies, and if it's a highly aggressive lymphoma or those that have increased risk for CNS involvement, you're going to do an LP to examine the CSF. And the staging is the traditional Ann Arbor staging classification, where stage one is involvement of one lymph node group. Generally, that's considered a lymph node group that can fit into one radiation port. Stage two is two or more lymph node groups on the same side of the diaphragm. And if it involves any extra lymph node tissue, that would be a 2E. Three is involving both sides of the diaphragm. And stage four is diffuse or disseminated involvement, and that includes bone marrow involvement. So your B symptoms, A is asymptomatic, and B is your B symptoms of fever, night sweats, or unexplained weight loss of 10% more of body weight in the past 6 months. The B doesn't stand for anything, just means that it's not A. And now they just generally use this for staging Hodgkin's lymphoma, not non-Hodgkin lymphoma. So treatment for non-Hodgkin lymphoma, like I mentioned earlier, if they're CD20 positive, Rituxan will be a part of that treatment plan, and those are only B cells that have that. T cells do not have that. So for a low-grade lymphoma, just like CLL, prominent treatment plans include Rituxan, sometimes bendamustine, or the CVP, which does not have Adriamycin in it like CHOP does. And the aggressive, you're usually going to use the R-CHOP, which is Cytoxan, Adriamycin, Oncovin, and Prednisone. And highly aggressive is some form of aggressive chemotherapy. Different docs have their different favorite ones. Hyper-CVAD is a famous one, and it usually includes high-dose methotrexate with it. So going over to Hodgkin's disease, this is 1% of all malignancies in the United States, and this was the first malignancy treated that demonstrated curative potential of combination chemotherapy. It's most common in young adults. There is an association with the Epstein-Barr virus, and this also arises from B lymphocytes, but is CD20 negative, so we don't use Rituxan on traditional Hodgkin disease. So this may be on the boards, and this is the diagnostic cell of Hodgkin lymphoma, or Hodgkin's disease. It's the Reed-Sternberg cell, and if you look at it, it looks like giant owl eyes. So generally, these lymph nodes are painless. So when people talk about, oh, I've got such painful lymph nodes, generally that's not going to be lymphoma. It's the Hodgkin lymphoma has kind of more rubbery feel to it as well, usually found in the neck and the mediastinal area. This is another etiology of mediastinal mass in a young person. So they can have really some unusual symptoms. One of the ones I've seen in my practice is alcohol-induced pain. So when they drink alcoholic beverages, they'll have pain in their involved lymph node sites. And I had one patient that stopped drinking any alcoholic beverages just before she was worked up for this, diagnosed with it because of the pain she was having in those areas. So the traditional Hodgkin lymphomas are the lymphocyte-predominant, nodular sclerosis, mixed cellularity, and lymphocyte-depleted. There's another one that's in a category by itself, nodular lymphocyte-predominant, and that's the one that can be CD20 positive. It's usually seen in young men, and it has a much more benign course, so therefore treated differently. So some of our poor prognostic factors, just like with any malignancy, advanced stage, a very large mediastinal mass, more than a third of the diameter of the chest cavity. If they're having systemic symptoms, the B symptoms, extranodal disease, which isn't rare, is not common, but it's rather rare, but can be seen. Advanced age, and men don't do as well. So the treatment has come full circle, and the standard of treatment right now is ABVD. Most of that slide is for reference only. I can't believe they put this on an exam, but just the ABVD, which is your standard regimen that you see now for treatment of these patients. So when we're treating young people or anybody with cancer, with chemotherapy, we have to be concerned about long-term side effects of these patients because especially the young people can go on to live 30, 40, 60, maybe 80 years, depending on how old they were when they were diagnosed. And some of these problems can occur decades down the road. So when there's radiation to the chest or the mantle area, there's any radiation to the neck area increases your risk for hypothyroidism. Heart disease, usually if they've had radiation to that chest area, 20 or 30 years later, they're going to end up needing bypass surgery. Increases their risk for lung and breast cancer. So they women need to start mammograms at a younger age. If they have periaortic or splenic radiation like they used to do before our current chemotherapy regimens, increased risk of gastric cancer. And then MOP chemotherapy, which I mentioned in an earlier lecture, a patient that we just had, increased risk for acute leukemia, and there's virtually 100% sterility. So when we're looking at these patients, we're looking at long-term side effects and constantly trying to make modifications for our treatment regimens to give them quality of life, not just quantity of life. So this is why Dr. Hubbard and I do what we do. When you look at this, survival 80-90% stage 1 and stage 2. When you look at stage 4, 60% long-term survival, which always makes us happy when we have to treat people with cancer. When I was first going into oncology, people say, why do you want to do that? That's so depressing. But we can say that we can cure more than half of the patients that are diagnosed with cancer, not counting skin cancers, which there's no other subspecialty in internal medicine can say that about their individual diseases. So let's move to multiple myeloma, and oh dear, this is one of the ones that's messed up as well. So there's a list of all the different plasma cell disorders. I don't know if you can make those words a little bit bigger, or we'll have to get you guys new slides. I apologize again. So when we're looking at multiple myeloma, think about how they present. And they can present with weakness and fatigue, bone pain. But the interesting thing is not very many present with renal failure or hypercalcemia. And so it's an important point to think about, because as the population ages with hypertension and diabetes, most of the patients are developing some kind of renal insufficiency. And so just because they have renal insufficiency doesn't mean that then when they get diagnosed with myeloma, that caused it. And so sometimes we get to the point where we need to do a kidney biopsy to differentiate between the two. So the vast majority of patients will present with some type of plasma cells in their bone marrow and have monoclonal protein. But again, it's not so common to see the renal insufficiency or hypercalcemia. But the vast majority also, I don't think you can see that there. I think bony lesions is about 67%. So looking at these pictures, this is what a plasma cell looks like. As I mentioned earlier, a subcategory of B lymphocytes go on to mature to become a plasma cell, and that's known by the eccentrically located nucleus in the perinuclear clear zone that you can see right there. And then when you look at the red blood cells under light microscope from just a blood draw, they look like pennies that have been stacked up and knocked down, and that's called rouleau formation. So the vast majority are IgG, but we can also have IgA, and very rare IgM and IgD, and some are light chain only. So when we're working these patients up, we need to do a serum protein electrophoresis, and that identifies the M protein or with an M spike. And then we get an immunofixation, which identifies the type of M protein that you have. Is it IgG, IgA, and what kind of light chain it is, kappa or lambda light chain. A bone marrow biopsy is important, as well as the whole lab with CBC can profile your quantitative immunoglobulins, your light chain, quantitative light chains, a beta 2 microglobulin, all important. And then patients will have a skeletal survey. This is different than a bone scan. So bone scan will light up if there's hot spots present in the bones, but a skeletal survey, or other some hospitals may call it metastatic survey, will x-ray, just plain x-rays, of the long bones as well as the skull to see if there's any lytic lesions. So when you make the diagnosis, you have to have evidence of some type of plasma cell disorder and one of the following, either lytic bone lesions, anemia, or hypercalcemia, or renal insufficiency that's caused by the myeloma. So treatment has been a variety over the years, and it continues to have new medications that are added. Right now, the main treatment of choice is dexamethasone with either Revlimid or Velcade, or sometimes a combination of all three. So MGUS is monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance, and that's where you just have an M spike that's less than 3 grams. You have on your serum protein electrophoresis, so you have normal calcium level, normal kidney function, and no anemia and no bone lesions. So smoldering myeloma, you have an M spike of greater than 3 grams, or a plasmacytoma, and you have no other bony lesions and normal calcium and kidney function again. So solitary plasmacytoma is a tumor that when it's removed is all plasma cells. And so these patients may or may not have a monoclonal protein, and they have no other signs of myeloma. But unfortunately, over the next few years, many of them go on, more than half go on to develop multiple myeloma that requires further treatment. Otherwise, with solitary plasmacytoma, the initial treatment is generally removal of the tumor if possible with consolidative radiation therapy. So Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia, also known as lymphoplasmacytic lymphoma, it's kind of like a kissing cousin that ties non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and myeloma together. It's generally, you'll have an elevated IgM. Now, the vast majority of IgM monoclonal proteins is Waldenstrom's, but there's a very small variant of IgMs that are multiple myeloma, but it's very rare. These patients will have adenopathy, which multiple myeloma patients do not. And they can have a hyperviscosity syndrome, because if you think about that IgM molecule, it's quite large, and so they're more prone to develop hyperviscosity. So the treatment is most commonly nowadays is using Rituximab and bendamustine. And if they're symptomatic with hyperviscosity, they'll need plasmapheresis. So amyloid is a group of diseases characterized, as you know, by deposition of insoluble protein in organs and tissues, resulting in that organ dysfunction. And usually the biopsy is taken from a fat pad, and it's stained with Congo red, and then there's an apple green birefringence under polarized light that makes your diagnosis. So, I'm sorry, I can't read all this, but this is an important slide, so we'll get to the slides. So consider if there's non-diabetic nephrotic syndrome, non-ischemic cardiomyopathy, if you have elevated liver enzymes or alkaline phosphatase without any evidence of any liver issues, and a peripheral neuropathy with an MGUS. This is really important to think about that. Especially if you find that you have monoclonal protein. So amyloid is only AL type, so when that biopsy is done, it comes back amyloid. You have to ask your pathologist to ask the send out lab where it's sent to, because your local pathologist is not doing this. But they have to identify the type of amyloid it is. And the only time that your hematologist, oncologist would treat this is if it's AL amyloid. The rest are usually localized things that are treated by the etiology is. So if it has a light chain monoclonal protein, then we would treat that from an oncology standpoint. That's more explanatory. Syndrome, all disorders, and they have a variable course. Patient to patient is always different, and it is ineffective maturation in the bone marrow. And usually there's a proliferation of these cells. It usually causes a hypercellular marrow in most cases, but because they're not maturing properly, they're not getting out of the bone marrow properly, and it results in a pancytopenia, and the incidence increases with age just like everything else. So other etiologies, toxic exposure, such as smoking and benzene exposure, people who work in the petroleum refinery business, there's increased risk of myelodysplasia for their exposure to benzene. So secondary related treatments, so from our wonderful chemotherapy and our radiation therapy, like I said, we're always trying to watch that we don't cause these problems for the patient down the road. And then some inherited disorders and then just arising de novo. So there's problems not only with quantitative anemia, thrombocytopenia, neutropenia, but the quality of these cells aren't as good either. So this was reclassified in 2008 by the World Health Organization into those different categories. And when we do the diagnosis, we're looking at cytogenetics because there are specific cytogenetic changes that diagnose the certain category of myelodysplasia that the patient is in and gives us a prognostication. So very favorable. And then favorable, you'll see that 5Q minus, that is important because it is has to do with the treatment that I'm going to talk to you about. And then, of course, unfavorable, anytime there's multiple cytogenetic changes, mutations, that's never a good thing. So some prognostic features that we use to categorize where the patient is in their diagnosis is the percentage of blasts that they might have, cytogenetics, number of cell lines involved, their age at time of diagnosis, and is it primary versus secondary. So treatment can be simple, such as Procrit or Aranesp. Our two most commonly used drugs right now are Idaza and Dacogen. And then Revlimid is one that's used only if they have 5Q minus mutation. Sometimes patients are young enough, they might be a candidate for bone marrow stem cell transplant. So I added on a new category that I added on to the end of this. You can come on up. I don't know if it's in your computer. It was porphyria. I noticed that we haven't been covering that, and so I just put it in there for your reference. Is just basically the two different categories. And again, if you have any questions, don't hesitate to call me. I'll try my best to answer or find some answers for you.